You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, John McWhorter.
Hello, Glenn Lowry.
Very good to be talking with you. I am indeed Glenn Lowry, and this is indeed The Glenn Show at bloggingheads.tv, also on YouTube. We are the self-styled black guys at bloggingheads.tv. John, are you tired of me referring to us in that manner?
Well, it's what we are. Listening for the first time, then we have to establish that. So, yes. No, I'm not tired of it at all.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, we're the black guys at bloggingheads.tv, and we often talk about issues of race and culture and politics in America. That's our beat. We don't only talk about that, but we seem drawn back to it over and over and over again.
For some reason. Yeah.
I don't want to speak for you. I think we have both in some way or another been struggling to define our professional and polemical identities in a way that doesn't reduce us to race commentary. Mm-hmm. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, I think both of us especially write and speak on things other than race elsewhere. But I think this medium and a lot of the issues that come up lends itself to us being our race selves. And so, yeah, it's at the point where I mostly do that here. So I value it for that, as a matter of fact.
Value it for the place where you can get your race thing out.
Yeah. Get it on, so to speak. Yeah.
Get it on.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, we are both professors. I'm at Brown University. You are at Columbia University. Therefore, we are eggheads and ivory tower types given to naval contemplation. One aspect of which is the meta conversation we have about the conversations that we have. Mm-hmm. Here at Blogging Heads, and the fact that we're black and we're talking about black stuff, and how does that make us feel, and how do other people react, and stuff like that. If we were to emphasize, for example, that I am, pardon me for saying so, other people should say it, a world-class economist with all the accolades to support that claim, you are an accomplished and prominent academic in your own field of linguistics with all of the accolades that would be necessary to justify that claim.
No, very few accolades. People don't give me prizes, but I take your point. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. Modesty would be one of your traits. You're a formidable figure in your field. You put out, when they decide that they're going to have a course, a talking course on the subject that you are an expert in, which is linguistics, they pick you to be the one who composes and narrates the course. Now, yes. To me, that's pretty significant.
I'll take it where I can get it, yeah.
Point I'm trying to make is people will get mad at us if we emphasize these mainstream credentials, as if to say that unlike some other people who are making a living in race commentary, some who in fact are very prominent and whose commentary has been widely disseminated, do not have anything like the chops that we bring to the table. Not only in the area of race commentary. So if we were to call that to anybody's attention, people would say, hey, man, y'all patting yourselves on the back. What are you trying to do? What are you trying to say? Ivy League? Brown? Columbia? Oh, I see. You think you're better than somebody else. That's what they would say.
They would say that. Yeah, it's funny. This is the honest truth. It never occurred to me until you just mentioned that we both are at Ivy League schools. I really never thought about that. That is true. And so some people would say, you know, that means, you know, it's that we're not real. You know, not only that we think we're better, but that we're not real. It's funny. The other day, you know, Twitter goes by so quickly, but the other day I was on the train and I opened it up and I looked at a little exchange that two guys were having where one of them was a white guy who listens to my language podcast and, you know, said that I had done one on the N-word, which I did. You know, I took one special episode of Lexicon Valley aside, and I said, folks, I don't usually do sociological issues on this, but I feel a responsibility to do the N-word. And I said, you know, very middle-of-the-road things. And the white guy was communicating with a black guy. And the black guy said, well, I guess I'll take a listen to that one, but I don't usually consult McWhorter for his political issues. And the white guy says back something like, well, why? I don't see why black people would be down on McWhorter. He seems to, you know, have pretty uninteresting takes on those sorts of things on Lexicon Valley. And then the black guy wrote, and you know what, I'm not even, you know, anybody who's listening to this can imagine, you know, this guy's sticking an angry hand up from the muck of 2005. So I'm just,
oh, John.
Traitorous person. And then they had a nice little exchange where it's interesting. The white guy says, well, yeah, I guess if you listen to Lexicon Valley, you get the feeling that he's had a rather exceptional set of experiences. And so maybe, and the white guy's saying this very nicely. I don't know why they kept me in this thread. Says that, you know, so maybe he hasn't had, I forget how he put it, but hasn't had the representative black experience.
Yeah.
And I found myself thinking, you know, well, what would that have been? You know, it's not like I was raised by a white couple and had no, you know, both of my parents were black until I was about 16. I had a, frankly, almost exclusively black life in most ways. And, you know, then things, you know, got a little more complicated. And yes, I married a white woman. But I thought, you know, it's interesting because with both of those people, including especially, you know, the black guy, you know, who thinks I'm such a terrible person, the, in the same breath, you know, just 2 seconds later, he in particular would be very quick to say that it's stereotyping to say that there's any kind of representative black experience. Right. Okay. So what is it that was so unblack about mine? And I guess what it comes down to, and you can correct me on this. I was thinking on the train. I guess the proper black experience is that I was supposed to be raised by and among black people who think of white people as other and probably don't like them very much and think of racism as a defining aspect of their identity. That they think of a defining aspect of being themselves as dealing with the endless slings and arrows of racism. And I thought, okay, well, if that is the proper real black experience, then yeah, I'm sorry. I guess I missed that. Although my mother didn't like white people very much. But yes, I would be lying if I said I had had that life. But I thought, isn't it interesting that the same people who would say that you're stereotyping to say there's a black experience will reject me as being representatively black, I think because, you know, I bring up Looney Tunes and show music and married a white woman and in general and, you know, writing and thinking about something other than Juneteenth, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and the last time somebody treated me badly because of my color. I just found that very interesting. So, yeah, maybe we're not authentic.
Well, the audience should be made aware if they if there's anyone out there who doesn't know that you are the author of a book entitled Authentically Black, in which
I thought I was.
You are indeed. You thought you were authentically black, but you know that you are the author of a book under that title.
I remember that.
And so you spent some time thinking about this, and I can imagine that you would, John. Well, let me ask you a question. This is a rude question. Does your skin tone, which is not especially dark, enter into the equation? It's a serious question. I don't mean to be rude, but do you feel that some people think that because you're not as dark as me, and I'm not especially dark, there are darker people, that you are somehow, just in virtue of that fact, less authentically black?
You know, I never thought so because I thought that that issue came in when you were, quote unquote, high yeller.
Yeah.
And I'm between. I mean, there's barely a word, but red is what some people use. But yeah. I always thought of myself as light-ish brown. But I always thought there was no question. But, you know, in terms of the muck of 2005, I did get occasionally people who thought I'm, quote unquote, light-skinned. And so I don't get the full brunt of the experience, which is horseshit, frankly, in terms of the sorts of things that you're supposed to be afraid of and you're supposed to worry about. The color of my skin has never made anybody think that I was somehow less black in my life. So, no, I don't think of it that way. Maybe if I were about 2 shades lighter, I would. But I always thought that there's no difference between you and me on that.
Another rude question, then. You are married to a white woman. You said that yourself. You said it that way. Do you think that that causes individuals who don't know you as well as I do, and therefore understand how black you are, do you think it causes those individuals to see you as less authentically black?
Oh, yeah, that's, you know, yeah. I mean, that they don't, so there are some people who don't like that. It used to be that if you Googled me, yes, I did Google myself more in the past than I do now, but it used to be the first thing that would come up under my name was John McWhorter Wife. And I frankly do not think that it was people looking to see whether or not I had one.
Are you kidding? Are you kidding? Oh,
they were
that
trying
was such
to get
an,
a look at what color she was.
That's an interesting thing.
Yeah, I'm not kidding.
You go that's John a, McWhorter that, and the thing would fill in the word wife because that's what people are searching
you
for.
You do a little scroll under, you know, John McWhorter Columbia, John McWhorter asshole, okay, whatever. Yeah. But the first thing that would come up is John McWhorter Wife. And so it's people, and
oh,
I thought that is people wondering who would have married him, as in what color she is. And, you know, there is a kind of black person who does prefer white romantic partners. I've known them. I've known them well. Anybody who knew my history would know that That is not my history. I made many, many efforts to find
John,
women.
Stop.
You
don't have to do that here, John.
No, not at all.
But this authenticity issue is a real issue, man. Because
Glenn, real quick. Yes. I will interject, and I'll just leave this out there. One of the people with three names that we talk about, and it's not, but one of the people with three names.
Well, who is it not?
It was not him. Doesn't know that I used to read their blog, and they called me out on this. So I just want to say that one of the three named people who is thought of as a very respectable person has in the past called me out for having married somebody of the wrong color. And that person, I don't even know if they remember who they are, but many people would be shocked that somebody they think of as so courtly and smart would pull something like that. This person did that before they knew what kind of audience they were going to
be. Now, let me just interject here because the audience may not understand the code words of the three names, you know, like Ta-Nehisi Coates or like Michael Eric Dyson, or I guess we could go with Henry Louis Gay. I mean, you know, there are a lot of people with three names. That's the universe to which John is cryptically referring without wanting to get any more specific than that.
Yes.
I'm shocked. Shocked, John, that anybody would, quote, call you out, close quote, on being a man who would, at one and the same time, dare to comment as a black person on black political affairs and also find your happiness and your life in marriage to a woman who happens to be Caucasian.
Yeah.
I'm shocked that anybody would say anything.
I can
like
tell
that.
How shocked you are.
It would appear to be a racist comment, John, would it not?
Well, black people can't be racist, Glenn.
Well, that brings us into the area that we want to talk about, and I really do want to talk about it, but let me just dwell on this marriage thing for a minute because I think it really is very interesting. If a white person were to say about another white person who happened to marry a black person, you married out of the race, shame on you, you're less authentic, why should I listen to what you have to say about white affairs?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It wouldn't be very hard to figure out that that was racism. I mean, that would appear to be racism. Come on now, come on.
What? Yeah.
Double standard doesn't do justice to the incoherence and moral sophomoric simplicity. I'm almost meant to say stupidity. It's not a serious position to say that it's okay to chastise somebody for marrying a white woman if they're black, and then at the same time to say you're a racist SOB for chastising somebody for marrying a black woman if you're white. There's no logic in that. That's a visceral, backward, orientation of thought. It's not a serious, and you know what the problem with it is? If it becomes widespread, if, for example, you start saying, when a white person kills a black person, that's a serious offense and we have to pull the rafters down about it. But when a black person kills another black person, what am I to expect? Because after all, people are caught in ghettos and they don't have opportunity. That would appear to be a kind of racism. It would appear to be a version, a flavor of something that's pretty stupid morally, not defensible. Now, if the rhetoric of a people in the hands of the three named parties comes to be captive to one such simplification and sophomoric stupidity after another with respect to moral valuation, what do you think will happen to those people?
Well, for one thing, they're going to be embraced by a very enthusiastic white intelligentsia. But I also think that they get caught up in, and we're talking about people in the plural at this point, they get caught up in something which I think, I have a kind of a compassion here. Sounds condescending, I don't mean it to be, but where all this comes from. You know, I'm not genuinely mad at that three-named person for saying that about me marrying a white person, because I know where that comes from. It's insecurity. This is Shelby Steele's point way back in Content of Our Character. On this, he was dead on. Where all that comes from is a quiet sense that black people are not quite as good. It's an internalization of the view of the oppressor, to put it in a cuddlier way. And so the assumption is that if a black person marries a white person, then probably, at least possibly, it's because the black person thinks that white people are better and doesn't think black people are good enough. You notice that that is less a feeling in most other groups. It doesn't mean that it isn't there, but that dialogue is different among modern Jews, not 100 years ago, but today among modern Jews. It's not something you hear as much among Asian Americans. Some, but not to the acrid extent that you get it among Black Americans, and it's because of insecurity. And so that person would say that about me, assuming that I must like white people better. And of course, what adds into that is partly the way I talk and, you know, credentials, et cetera, et cetera. But with this person in particular, they ought to be ashamed of themselves because their credentials are rather similar. And that's where you get a whole lot of things, such as what you just mentioned. The idea that it's worse when a white person kills a black person than when a black person does it. That comes partly from a sense that, well, we can't quite help it. We're not as good as other people. There's something lowly about us. And you can phrase it as that somebody made us lowlier, that we're penned into ghettos. But again, nobody Jewish ever thought that way. That was not something that the Irish said for longer than about 5 minutes when they were quote unquote black and penned into ghettos. That's something with us. And it's a whole late 20th century dialogue. So it's insecurity. And so you can call it stupid.
Well, but it's also insecurity. I think you're actually wrong about the Jewish point, and it puts me in mind of a book by a man named Cudahy called The Ordeal of Civility. I don't know if you've ever come across it.
Not at all.
It's a minor classic. I think it's a neglected piece of social theoretic reflection. What Cudahy, John Murray Cudahy is his name. He's a Catholic intellectual, as it happens, and he writes this book, which is critical of Jewish intellectual orientation in the Europe during the period from like early 19th century through early 20th. He focuses on Marx, Freud, and Levi-Strauss. So Marx is the political economist, Freud is the psychologist, and Levi-Strauss is the anthropologist. And The Ordeal of Civility's argument in a nutshell, okay, I can't obviously lecture on this book, is that the assimilation of the shtetl Jew into German European high culture left people in some ways or another feeling insecure and ashamed of their social status. Mm-hmm. Some of these people were very brilliant people whose psychological impairment or constraint associated with being assimilating Jews filtered into the Weltanschauungs that they elaborated in their respective corpus of work. Mm-hmm. So within the interstices of Marxism, one could find this. Certainly within Freud, you could find it, argues Cudahy, and also in Levi-Strauss. Again, I can't recapitulate the argument in full. Bottom line, however, is serious people have thought, and there are books on the shelf out there that explore the implications in an earlier period, not American Jewish social history, but European Jewish social history, in which this shame issue and this status and fitting in and doubts about that had profound effects on people's orientation. So I say all that. The other thing I have to say, I don't want to go on too long, John, because I know you don't want to be shut out of the conversation. You have so much to say. But the other thing I just have to speak up for the people who I'm sure are pulling your hair out there. If you say African-Americans use of a, quote, double standard, close quote, with respect to racial violation is a reflection of insecurity. And they're going to say, no, it's not. It's a reflection of white supremacy. Of course, they're going to say that. But they're actually going to mean something by it that I think we ought to bother to consider. Before we just dismiss it, and what they're going to mean is that black people have been on the defensive against the presumption of their lack of a full humanity from day one. The very institution of slavery, you say, why are you mentioning slavery? Slavery is not relevant in the 21st century. Well, no. The direct social, sort of causal impact of slavery, it may not be so relevant. But the psychology of slavery and how it infects the perception of the black and the white mind is very much durable and has its roots in slavery. And what that had to do with the dehumanization of black people. So when we talk about things in which the humanity of black people is at stake, for example, we talk about whether there are genetic factors that account for racial differences in performance on intelligence tests, or we talk about the intermarriage rates and, you know, the selective decisions that some people with the means of, enhancing the, you know, African-American community and whatnot, marry out to others who are outside of me and things like that. When we talk about that, when we talk about the use of the N-word, you know, a rapper can use it and it's no problem. But when a white person uses it, even if that particular white person is a rapper, and even if that particular rapper spent all their time around black people in the ghetto, never mind. When a white person uses it, it means something different. That's because we're operating against this backdrop. And defense of our humanity has become a first order proposition. And the imposition of certain kinds of restraints that might seem to violate liberal principle, but that are an apparent necessity in our circumstance, shouldn't be judged with the same harshness as we would from people coming from the other side, an argument like that. So how would you respond to that?
I think that what you said was brilliant. It was brilliantly put, and it also puts the people we're talking about into a corner. Because I say, yes, all of that is true, and now tell me that a condition of that, a result of that, is not a deep-seated socio-psychological insecurity. Yes, that's what slavery did. That's what Jim Crow did. That's what any number of things now could be argued to do, although I think the argument gets weak after about 1965. But yes, all those things are true. Yes, we have to have a more refined form of judgment about all kinds of things because of that legacy, to use that favorite term. But that means that, yes, at the heart of the soul of a great many Black American people today, regardless of socioeconomic level or educational level, is a certain insecurity about Blackness as compared to whiteness, which could be brought out by all kinds of subtle psychological tests, and is also plainly obvious in how absurd it is otherwise to have such a resentment against people marrying out, to have, you know, such an easy sense of acceptance of these arguments about people being penned into ghettos and therefore it being inevitable for them to shoot each other. It is why so often Caribbean Black immigrants and immigrants from Africa are not of a mind with Black America on things like this. There are a great many African immigrants in particular who don't get the sheer humility in the argument that because we're all poor and penned into the ghetto, of course our boys are going to start shooting each other, and all that has to be understood as the result of racism. There are people with thick accents from Nigeria who think that that is ridiculous, and they are frankly blacker than any of us. And that's because of our history. Certainly, our history. But it does create some distortive attitudes that I don't think all of us have gotten past. And so, yeah.
Yeah. I know some of those people with thick accents from Nigeria.
I know you know.
Kenya, yeah. And South Africa.
They get it. Et cetera. Yep, and that's the reason.
And it is, it always does strike me. I mean, they don't mean to be rude or unhelpful, but their eyebrows are very firmly raised when they look around at African American social life.
Yeah.
But I want to put something else on the table about this double standard thing, this thing that, you know, the racialism associated with sort of defining relationships and value apparently in a manner that depends upon the whether a person is Black or they're white or whatever, that when undertaken by Black people is not as bad an offense. And I just gave what I thought was a summary of what I could imagine to be the counterargument against what I've been saying, which is that I think it's a morally sophomoric posture that's ruinous in the long run for Black people to adopt. And the person might say, well, have you looked at history? Black people are not in the position of being able to indulge all the luxury of your liberalism. My colleague here, Trisha Rose, has a talk she's giving now. She just gave it at the American Academy in Berlin. I saw it advertised. Something about the delusion of liberal colorblindness, you know, and I haven't heard the talk, so I probably shouldn't comment, but I think I have heard the talk actually. And I think the way it goes,
we've both heard it many times. Yeah.
We've heard it, you know, it's a trap. If you go into colorblindness, it's a turning away from being able to deal with the consequences of white supremacy and the subtle ways in which it manifests itself, notwithstanding the formal embrace of colorblind principles. It still operates at a subterranean level to impede and devalue Black people. Mm-hmm. That's how this argument might go. But I want to argue against all of that and say there are moral principles that are at stake. I mean, I've said this before. The nails in the coffin of Jim Crow were driven by high-minded ideals like what Martin Luther King was saying in that speech in 1963 about his little kids walking hand in hand and race not being significant. That's not a delusion. That's a principle. Now, it may be that strict adherence to the principle in a sort of lockstep manner at all times is not a practical thing, but you don't lose sight of the principle. You don't trash the principle. You don't trash the principle of free speech because some people's speech can be harmful, because you're trying to maintain a community, because you have vulnerable people at your college campus, because people have been, you know, whether they're women or they're gays or they're Blacks or they're Native people, subject to the forces of history. You don't abandon the principle, and you don't abandon this transracial humanism principle. This is what I want to say. This is the position that I would stake out. Fought for and wrought. It didn't just drop from the sky. I mean, how silly. How silly to labor. I'm a man. I'm a man. I'm a man. I'm a man. For 300 years, people like to talk about 300 years. How silly to fight against the Enlightenment philosophers who thought you were less than a man and the segregationists, Apollinists, those who thought you were less than a man, and the slave-owning self-justifiers who thought you were less than a man. How silly to argue against, I'm a man, I'm a man, I'm a man, which is to say the particulars, the accident of circumstance of my race is irrelevant to an assessment of my humanity. And it's irrelevant to any evaluation of what it is I have to contribute, irrelevant to my access to opportunity, irrelevant to my social position, blah, 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 blah. How silly to have argued that. And then, willy-nilly, on behalf of what? Special dispensation from an administrative state? You can get classified as being one of these people and therefore you can get an extra benefit? You know, I mean, political preference? Deference in the media? And let me stop because I go on. I mean, I just want to say, let's not abandon this principle of transracial humanism, and therefore, let's not be indifferent about the daily affront to that principle, which is reflected in the behavior of some of many commenting on contemporary events who want to give African Americans a get out of jail free card, who want to give us an exemption, who want to say, well, no, it's quite all right. If you do it, we understand. No.
See, I understand the principle of what you're saying. I understand the logic of it. But, you know, I don't. One difference between you and me, Glenn, I think, is that, and it's funny, I read things these days, and I think it's partly that I had a delicate upbringing. My parents did not like each other, and neither one of them should ever have been parents. I say that with love for them.
Wow.
But when you are, yeah, I would let some of this out back in the past, and people would say, oh, well, now that's why his views are so wrong. I should say that I was not an unhappy child. I just look back and realize that there were things in the house that affected me. When you grow up in that kind of house, of a house that was more like ordinary people than like an August Wilson play, and I think a lot of people find that hard to believe when the people are black.
Wow, John.
It was not what people like to imagine, that kind of warm working class, you know, thing that you see in plays and in movies. That wasn't it.
Wow.
When you grow up in that kind of house, apparently it teaches you to kind of burrow yourself into people's heads because you're never sure of what's coming. You know, and nothing was coming. I wasn't abused or anything like that, but my parents were prickly. And I think that's part of why when you say what you're saying, I think, sure, yes, logically, the way it is now would make no sense to Bayard Rustin, to A. Philip Randolph. You know, just this is a complete detour. All of this special dispensation when all that time the idea was we wish to be equals. It's a tragic detour. But then I find myself putting myself into the head of the kind of person we're dealing with. And let's use Trisha Rose. Trisha doesn't like me, and so I think it's fair for me to just say that she did an interview, a passing interview, I forget in which newspaper, when she was teaching at UC Santa Cruz, where she very casually and jocularly said about lovely little Santa Cruz that it was a place that had so much unfettered whiteness in Santa Cruz. And I suppose that's true. But notice that if anybody had said that certain parts of Atlanta are full of unfettered blackness, then they would be asked to leave the planet at this point. But she can say unfettered whiteness because she's punching up. Now, there's that, and then there are Trisha's views on, you know, everything else, including how all white people are complicit in the evil of racism, et cetera, et cetera. And whatever you want to say about that, she clearly is very angry at white people, disgusted at white people. That sense of anger and disgust forms the basis of a whole individual psychology for a certain kind of person. And that kind of person is very common and probably overrepresented in academia. I'm not implying that she's some sort of freak or something like that. But if you put yourself into the head of that person, you find yourself able to see that that person can't hear you. They're just too mad. And Trisha, I'm just picking because you mentioned her, but I know some people personally. They walk around so angry at white racism. I'm thinking now of an Asian one, actually. It's the foundation of the way they see themselves navigating the world. And they could never hear this. They could just never hear it. As far as they're concerned, the way we think of it now is an advance
Let me just interject a piece of information, John, okay. And then I want you to continue. I want people to know that Tricia Rose is a professor here at Brown. She's my colleague. She's a professor of Africana Studies and director of the Center for the Study of Race and Ethnicity in America. She writes about Afro-American culture, African-American culture, hip-hop, and so on. I can't give you the titles of her books, but her books are out there.
One of them was called Black Noise. I think that was her most popular.
I'm not sure that's the most recent one, but I think that was the book that made her name for herself. She is my colleague here. I don't want to contribute unduly to her disparagement, or I would appear to be not collegial, and she's not here to speak for herself, although I would be happy to have Tricia Rose as an interview partner here on the Glenn Show at some point. Yeah, well, it'll be fireworks, man. You know,
good luck.
We'll take the gloves off and slug it out.
I'll watch that one. Yeah.
What did I want to say about, not liking white people? Yeah, you know, I mean, I'll say this on the air. I got colleagues here at Brown, they happen to be white, who think she's a racist.
I've heard that often from white friends.
The public presentation, the way in which he carries on, someone. Now, maybe they're over the top, whatever. That's a very hard word to be throwing around about people. I'm not endorsing that claim about my colleague Tricia Rose, though I understand the motivation for a person having made it. I wouldn't call these people, these black people whom I have said, although I did say they were acts of racism, who have benefited from a double standard because they can do things like complain that a black man marries a white woman, but would at the same time complain, if any white person complained about a white woman marrying a black man, I say that this is a problem. And I do think it is a problem, and I do think it's a cousin of racism, if it's not racism itself. But the label, someone is a racist, that goes to their character. It says they harbor an irrational enmity, that they are misanthropic in a certain sense. And I think it's a heavy charge that wants to be justified. So I'm not making that charge against my colleague. But you know, you said Bayard Rustin, A. Philip Randolph wouldn't get this, and I think you're right. And I think one of the things that they wouldn't get about it is there's a class dimension to everything that we've been talking about here, in the sense that the people with the three letters in their name, the three names, and so forth, I mean, this is not a working class situation. This is an elite. This is an elite situation. The people who are writing at the New Yorker and at the Atlantic and whatnot, the Jelani Cobbs and the Ta-Nehisi Coates of the world, and I know what they will say. They will say, wait, I came up from slavery. I came up from deprivation and poverty. Blah, 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 blah. Man, y'all so far from the labor movement. You're so far from union politics. You're so far from working class issues. You're so far from advocating about a social policy and a social safety net. You're so far from a politics of the left, a serious politics. This is what your colleague Mark Lillo is saying in that book that everybody's mad about, but they ought to actually stop and read it. And then after they read, they ought to think about it. What's a future liberal? You're so far from a progressive movement, from an analysis of the structural conditions. All you're doing is you're bandying about these words and these labels. It's a pose. It's a posture. It's an act. Or in your metaphor, it's a worship service. It's a tent revival. It's a sermon. It's a prayer. But it ain't politics. This much I know.
I think the thing is, you want to ask them. I've sometimes thrown it out into the air. What is it about being a descendant of African slaves in the late 20th century that makes everything different? You know, people all over the world, you know, including Africa, have, you know, gotten up and gotten over. And, you know, history is messy. A lot of tragedy occurs. Unfair and unfair are always mixed together. But, you know, many, many groups have risen up. But somehow there's an idea that, I guess maybe to give it the most leeway, something about a post-industrial, first world, late 20th society is one where the descendants of slaves, I guess given certain particularities of the history, can't be expected to make the best of themselves, that something is different. Now, I would be interested in hearing that argument, but it's funny. Rustin tried arguments like this that ended up not being borne out by what happened in the 70s and the 80s, but at least he tried. Maybe I'm ignorant, and so I'm unaware of that argument now. But I get the feeling that a lot of the people that we're talking about would say that the way somebody from 1946 would have gone about our problems was unadvanced, that we know now that there is a certain fundamental protean injustice about discrimination and racist sentiment that we need to address in a way that Mary McLeod Bethune just didn't live in a society advanced enough to understand, and that therefore we're ahead of the curve, that we've learned something, that we are advanced in saying that we cannot be expected to get ahead without special set-asides and, you know, a whole different sense of what morality consists of because of our history. Now, maybe now I will say this one last thing. If these points have been made only in dense academic tomes that only four people ever read, then they haven't been made. I feel ignorant if these points have been made in, you know, maybe intellectual but public forums. Have you ever seen anybody since 1965 in Commentary Magazine make a point as to why it's different for us at this time? This is a genuine question.
Well,
other than somebody saying that it's because we have dark skin.
Well, it's a big question. It's a very big question. I think in every discipline you find efforts to grapple amongst progressives, not only African-Americans, but whites as well, who are sympathetic to the aspirations and the postures adopted by African-American intellectuals and leaders. You find in every field efforts to grapple with, you know, this post-civil rights reality. I mean, basically the revolution of the night, this is Glenn Lowry, but I think I can back it up, the 60s, 1950s and 60s, was monumental. It was where it was historic shift in the citizenship status and the economic opportunity and so forth of African Americans. It was really historic. I mean, the numbers are all pointing in the same direction with respect to that. I mean, there's still vast inequalities. I'm not unaware of that. I'm talking about what happened in the 1950s and 1960s. So now you get, and again, I won't go on too long because I've said this here before, a period of stagnation. I mean, you get a middle class coming into existence that didn't exist before, but you got a vast so-called underclass or marginal class of people who are languishing, the ones about whom those African immigrant observers would raise their eyebrows. They think there's streets are paved with gold in this country. You know, get up and get busy, and they don't understand why African Americans still do. So in every discipline, you have this. I think in psychology, and again, I don't mean to disparage people's work. These are important work, but a stereotype threat that has made Claude Steele famous. This is the hypothesis that African Americans, anticipating that the results of performance on a test will be taken by observers to be emblematic of what black people can and cannot do, and believing that they can't do well, experience a kind of anxiety or mental impairment that actually lowers their performance on the test. And therefore one has to, A, be skeptical about what the test differences between blacks and white might actually measure, and B, be mindful of the larger atmospheric conditions that impede and inhibit the expression of intellectual performance by African Americans, all this kind of stuff. So this is an industry, man. This is a vast and far-flung, wealth disparity. Okay, I'm going from field to field in economics. The wealth disparity. So African Americans have less wealth. The median wealth comparison, that median black family makes $10, has $10 in wealth for every $1,000 in the median white family. When I could critique use of these statistics and so on, obviously there is a wealth disparity. How significant it is for the number of people who are in prison or the number of people who are on food stamps by race is something that one could argue. Does it explain the SAT test score gap? I don't really think so. In any case, there's a whole industry out there aimed at chronicling and trumpeting these disparities. Yes, the disparities do exist. Do they get to the bottom of things? Mass incarceration. So Ava DuVernay makes a film, The 13th, which is about how the 13th Amendment, which actually, if you read it, would appear to be emancipating the slaves, is in fact, no, it's actually a con. Because there's an exception in there that says, except for people, no involuntary servitude, except for those duly convicted of crimes. So you see, they snuck through the back door the way to continue slavery by another means. Michelle Alexander's the new Jim Crow. You see, a lot of black kids are in prison. A lot of them. Well, you know, it's all about the racist, biased enforcement of drug laws. It's all about cops who patrol in black communities and don't patrol. No, it's not. If you actually look at the numbers, bias, however liberally interpreted, can't explain anything close to the magnitude of the disparity in African Americans and criminal offending. Can't explain it in homicide, can't explain it in robberies, can't explain it in domestic violence, and to the extent that it exists in other areas. The bias doesn't account for the overrepresentation of African Americans in prisons. Another kind of story is going to have to be told. But in one area after another, you see this. So, you know, I'm not sure what this comes to in response to your to the question that you put to me, but I think apologia is the word that I am looking for. A-P-O-L-O-G-I-A.
Mm-hmm.
Apologia. We're in the apology business, many of us social scientists, with respect to racial issues. We're in the business of hunting for as yet undiscovered subtle mechanisms of repression. Anything to avoid placing the responsibility on the victims. Okay? Anything to avoid talking about culture. You miscreant, low bottom feeding, politics of respectability, Moynihan-esque, want to go back to the 1950s, Amy Watts conservative. Okay? If I start talking about the family, where are the fathers? Okay? Mm-hmm. If I start talking about, do you know where your kid is? It's 11 o'clock at night. Do you know where your kid is? If I start talking about, when was the last time you went to a parent-teacher meeting at the school? If I start talking about charter schools, if I start talking about putting responsibility in the hands of poor people, a ton of bricks is going to, if I call attention to the differences in the abortion rates amongst African Americans and whites, I'm not a pro-life ideologue over here if anybody is wondering it, but I do get to mention it. Okay? I'm not going to shut up about the fact that it's twice as high amongst African Americans. Do you think that's a reflection of a healthy society? I don't. No, I'm not trying to take any woman's right. I'm not trying to get into her uterus and put my political hands all over her autonomy. I'm talking about the way people are living. Okay? Nobody wants to deal with these things in a forthright manner. It's apologia. We're in the business of end running around common sense. We're looking for an end run around common sense so as not to hold the purported victim responsible.
Yeah, and we both know that the people in question would say that what you're missing is that you don't understand how large the effect can be of even subtle biases, of unintentional biases, you know. And so if you have to worry that you're going to wind up arrested when you want to hang around a Starbucks without actually drinking a cup of coffee for a little while, then imagine what that can do to your psychology. Or here's another one. You know how it's at the point where I've read between the world and me without ever having picked it up because I read what other people say about it?
Okay.
It's at the point where
if you say so.
Oh, I can practically recite it like the Quran.
All right.
I've seen Get Out. You know, I refuse to go see Get Out because
I know what you mean. I have seen Get Out. It's worth seeing.
I've seen it now. And so
okay.
I haven't seen it, but I keep reading these things. So, for example, that scene at the end where the protagonist is hurt and Allison Williams is laying down on the ground, extremely hurt, and there's a car coming, police car coming, and he's worried that the police are going to think that he did it. Remember that very touching scene?
Yeah.
Which I've never seen, but that scene? Well, many people are thinking that what you need to think about is how that Daniel Kalapuya character feels in a situation like that and how that can color his whole existence and even the worldview that he would pass on to his children, that he can't count on the stewards of society not to basically lynch him in a situation like that. And that's what these people's answer is, that the people in the past didn't understand the nature of bias and that we're advanced in obsessing over it the way that we do. And I wonder if there's a way of getting the message out that there are biases, but that even if you're the descendant of an African slave, even if you've got brown skin, it doesn't matter that black and get back rhyme. What is it? If you're brown, stick around.
Yeah.
If you're black, get back. And there's some third part.
Right.
Just because black and get back rhyme doesn't mean that brown skin makes it different. But that's what you'd have to get through to people, because what everybody is thinking now is about Get Out and how he feels when that car is coming in that scene near the end. I hope that scene is near the end. I'm imagining it's near the end.
Yeah, it's at the end. Oh, man. What do I want to say about that? I want to say it's hysteria. It's hysteria. There's no empirical basis. Oh, God, I will get into trouble. It's a country of 300 million people, man. Do you know how many encounters there are between law enforcement officers and citizens on a given day?
Well, and I'm going to interrupt you a second.
Yes,
dude, Starbucks. Starbucks.
Okay, man, please.
Starbucks.
Please.
That's what people are going to say.
Well, okay, they'll get mad at me, too. Am I mistaken in thinking that the gentleman in question who ended up being arrested refused a respectfully conveyed request that they not be in the premises on the basis of the rules of the establishment, attended by a person who was in a position of authority to make such a statement, and that when the police arrived, having been called by the person whose respectful request was refused, they refused the police's respectful request to leave the premises. Now, that actually doesn't look to me like a reign of terror on people trying to have cups of coffee who haven't had brown skin. Okay? It doesn't look to me like that. Now, were those reasonable requests? Blah, 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 blah. Please, please, please. Is that emblematic of what it means to be black in America? How ridiculous. Okay? I don't believe it. I don't believe it for a minute. And I'm black in America. Have I ever experienced racism? Yes. Including recently. I could tell you about it, but it'd be a waste of our time. Okay? Now, teaching our children that they need to be afraid if they have to call upon an emergency medical service in Alabama that happens to be white, or I don't know what they're going to do to me. If they need to call upon a police officer because you can find an instance in which a person of color, do you think that this kind of thing doesn't happen to white people?
They do think that.
Well, they're wrong. I mean, they're like monumentally and monstrously wrong. It's a country of 300 plus million people. There are hundreds of thousands of encounters between law enforcement and citizens every day. You get a videotape once a month. You know, I mean, it's ideology, or if you will, religion. It is an effort to cherry pick experience on behalf of a narrative. The narrative is wrong at its root. Okay, so I'm against the NFL players' protest. Ah, ha! Okay, now get mad at me. I want you to get mad at me because maybe then you'll think. I'm against the NFL players' protest for the following reason. Do they have the right to? Yes, they do. Are the NFL owners a bunch of billionaire assholes? Probably. Is Donald Trump an asshole for trying to make politics out of this? Certainly. Okay? Here's what I'm against. Assimilating a concern about the way in which certain communities are policed and how people of color are affected by that policing to a question of whether or not the country as a whole and its civic and patriotic rituals are worth observing and affirming. Okay, what did Colin Kaepernick say? I can almost quote it. I'm not going to salute a country or a flag of a country where people are, you know, run down by cops, wearing socks with, you know, cops depicted as pigs on the socks, whatever, whatever. America is bankrupt because Michael Brown or Trayvon Martin got shot down. America is bankrupt. Okay. That is not what I think we should be teaching to our children. Again, I know that people are going to get very, very upset with me. We have a huge stake in the future of this country and in how it is that we fit into this country, to carve out this posture of fundamental antagonism toward basic institutions of the country because we have a beef? This is not 1953. As a matter of fact, there is so much in the history of this country vis-a-vis this question of the status of black that's worth affirming, because very hard and difficult things got done that vastly expanded the rights and protections and the standings of African Americans. My God, we draw congressional districts to make sure that black people get elected to the Congress. My God, we bend over backwards in reinterpreting our standards to ensure that African Americans are represented in the most elite venues of selection in this country, even though it would appear we are not, on the whole and on the average, performing at levels that would warrant that. I mean, it's childish, in my opinion. Again, people are going to get mad at me. I want you to get mad at me. It's not growing up. Who ever said that the world was going to be completely fair? Count your blessings. You're in the richest, freest country on planet. Again, you're going to get angry with me for saying the obvious. For saying the obvious. You are a citizen of Rome in Rome. Okay? So I don't have any patience for it. And guess what? There are a lot of Americans who don't have any patience for it. Some of them who are not going to be as forthright as me because they're not black and they can't get away with it to the extent that I can get away with it. But they can vote. There are a lot of people who are fed up to here with interstates being shut down because black criminals got treated roughly by the local gendarme. That's what they say in suburban St. Louis or suburban Baltimore. That's what they say when these people go on the march and they start burning down shit.
You know, the late 20th century did create something unique, which is this. It gives a readier place than I think any other time in human history has to building an identity around, kind of a defensive identity, around victimhood, out of being the noble victim. It's not that that personality didn't exist before, but one of the unpleasant byproducts of the Civil Rights Revolution was that that kind of identity, that kind of racial identity, became a ready way for a person who happens to be black to build their sense of legitimacy on this earth. It's hard for any human being to grow up. It's hard to, you know, go from age 8 to 18. One thing that a black person can grab hold onto is that idea that however you feel about everything else, your legitimacy is conferred by the fact that you are a victim or you are representing your race who are victims. And so, that's good what you say about how the athletes are kneeling, something which I've written in agreement about, despite the fact that this is a country that bends over backwards for black people in so many ways, in a way that no society has ever done before for oppressed people. You know, we are a post-civil rights society in so many ways, and here they are down on their knees because of cop shootings. And I think part of the reason for that is that part of black identity is something that seeks that role, seeks that kind of agreement. And that's not to say that the deaths of various people, mostly men, at the hands of police were not tragic events in themselves. But for example, the fact that you and I have explored here, which I learned here, which is that these sorts of things happen to white people just as much in exactly the same ways, is not something that Colin Kaepernick knows. And I have written in support of Colin Kaepernick, but thinking of it in the way you're thinking, here he is down on the ground, not knowing that black people are treated overall in this country in a way that nobody could have imagined in 1964. It's partly because he's been taught that the black cop problem is exactly what the media says that it is. And if you wonder why somebody like him or all the other players aren't thinking about the 95% of other things going on in society that are so pro-black, ahistorically pro-black, it's because there is a sense that you are doing the right thing, you are forging an identity by having that perspective on what it is to be black. If anything, because you're successful and you're getting rich, if you're lucky enough to be getting rich, then you certainly are going to want to give that nod to the people who've been left behind. That's what black American is. And that's a hard thing to resist. I think that's a very hard thing for a people to resist when now it's been so many generations that the only way you often hear a different way of being black is either from somebody from another country where you can say that they just don't understand what's going on, or you get a few weirdos like you and me where we're not real because we're opportunists or because we didn't grow up poor enough or because we teach at Ivy League universities. As somebody said about me in the New Yorker last year, we are bringing a bouquet of Moynihan flowers to the door just at the time when they start to wilt. And so the black conservative revolution, I like that actually.
Who said that? Are you prepared to tell me?
That is Vincent Cunningham, who was reviewing my book, Talking Back, Talking Black. And I thought that damn good.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a good line. I think you have to give that.
He wrote that well. And so we don't count because we've got these drooping flowers. And I get it. I sympathize with Colin Kaepernick. I get where he's coming from. He's not going to see it the way we see it. Can you at least sympathize with him and not think of him as a jackass?
Yeah. I mean, I guess. I'm not in a hurry to think of him as a jackass. I don't want to call him names. I think it's a mistake. I don't, I've said why. But I see the logic of what you're saying, and perhaps this, especially being, if you're someone who's extraordinarily successful in sports or entertainment or whatever it might be, and you have a lot of money, and, you're kind of, there could be a survivor guilt dimension to that or something, or a desire for authenticity,
exactly.
For street cred or something like that, whatever.
Yeah,
I don't want to speculate about what's motivating this brother, because I don't know him from, Adam. But I can kind of see that. And again, I'm saying, although I did use the word ridiculous, stupid, sophomore, idiotic, it is like I'm in a hurry to call people stupid. So maybe I need to check myself on that.
You did say that.
Okay. What's your take on the Roseanne Barr situation, John?
Well, actually, we have to do this quickly because I have to jump on a train. But
okay.
I think it's interesting. You punch down, you punch to the side, you punch up. And so we've learned that you can say horrible things or, unsavory things. And if you're seen as punching up, so Samantha Bee calls Ivanka Trump a cunt, then that's unfortunate, but Samantha Bee keeps her job. If you are Joy Reid, who I adore, but Joy Reid had some less than PC things to say about homosexuality in her blog 10 years ago, and that is discovered, well, you can get away with that because Joy Reid is black and a woman, and so it's seen as, I guess, punching across to say those things about gay men. And so Joy gets to keep her job, which she should, I think. And then you have Roseanne, and she says Valerie Jarrett looks like a monkey. And
across between the Muslim Brotherhood and the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, and I don't know what the Muslim Brotherhood part means, but Planet of the Apes.
She was born in Iran. She was born in Iran to American parents. She was born in Iran.
Okay.
And I don't know. She might have been sympathetic to the Arab Spring or whatever. I mean,
right.
Who knows, man?
And she loses her TV show instantly because she's a white woman saying something racist. I find it interesting that racism has a power that these other things don't. You can look at the various cases and see. And there are other ways of punching down, such as a man being sexist. And I don't mean Harvey Weinstein's physical, absolutely disgusting, but I mean the sorts of things you can say about...
You mean calling a woman a cunt.
Right. So if a man called a woman a cunt from some high position, I'm sure that, if some newscaster did that, he would lose his job immediately too. But racism is in there as one of those forms of punching down that is absolutely uncountenanced. And so you're going to lose it right there. Whereas if you punch across or if you punch up, then everybody talks about regrettable, but you've learned and let's all move on.
So
that was my take.
Here's an interesting thought experiment. What if Bill Maher, and he well might have done, had said about Ivanka Trump, "You feckless cunt"? Would there be dissonance and confusion on the left as people tried to sort out which of the offenses was the more...
He would lose his job. It'd be confusing, but he couldn't do that.
He'd definitely be taking it taking a big chance on it, I think.
Yeah.
Punch down, punch up, punch sideways. Okay, so about Joy Reid, I have to say, 10 years ago, she said she thought homosexual sex was disgusting. Is that not
what most people probably think it is? Right. Yeah.
She said that most people probably think it is.
She said most people think that the sight of two men kissing is kind of gross. She said that. Yes.
Okay. The reason that I laugh, and my son is gay, and I am in full support of the LGBTQ agenda, or at least most of it.
We can talk about the rest of it next time.
Yeah, or me and my son can talk about it. We got posts up in the archives at Blogging Heads where he and I go back and forth about sexuality issues. We're not entirely on the same page. I want him to be a little bit more forgiving in the cultural victory that he and his cohorts are evidently enjoying, although I'm aware that the Supreme Court just decided against the gay community in the
Masterpiece
gay case.
Right.
Yeah, in the Masterpiece case. But anyway. Joy Reid expresses the view 10 years ago that she imagines most people would find it gross to see two men kissing. A, that might be an accurate description of what most people would think 10 years ago, or maybe even today, for all I know.
Yeah.
B, finding something gross is not the same thing as being homophobic. My God. You don't get to find stuff gross. Some people think the missionary position is gross. They think it smacks a Leave It to Beaver 1950 conformity, for crying out loud. For crying out loud. I can't have an opinion about people's sexual practices without somehow stripping them of their humanity. You're going to insist that I agree with your aesthetics, or else I'm politically unacceptable, for crying out loud. That's a minor form of tyranny. Minor, okay? But we don't have any need of it whatsoever. Joy Reid today could 10 years ago have thought that she wanted to look away when she saw two men kissing and still be fully on the side of justice and equality for people, for crying out loud. Otherwise, let me just finish this. You force us to be liars. You drive us into the practice of simply grinning in your face and telling you what you want to hear. Will you please grow up? Thank you.
I think the things that Joy said were unideal, but yes, you could take them as representative of what many people do feel. And the idea that she was talking down gay people in a way that was incommensurate with wishing gay people the best and being in favor of all sorts of aspects of the LGBT movement going on today, I think it was kind of hasty. Now, on the other hand, 10 years ago was not that long ago. I would never say that something that I wrote in 2008 doesn't represent the person that I am right now, especially since I'm not 30 years old. I find that a little weak. 10 years ago was 10 minutes ago. I'm wearing some pants that I had 10 years ago right now. And so, not that. But I think Joy deserves to have her job. I think that there should be room for an apology. But it's interesting how Roseanne could not apologize.
Well, definitely over the line, no doubt about that. And you can imagine the boycott of advertisers that would have ensued if they had tried to air the program as if nothing had happened. They probably made a sound business decision, as well as people will say the correct, more the righteous call in that particular case. Now, you say Samantha Bee won't lose her job because, after all, punching down, punching sideways. And I think your prognosis is correct. I don't expect that TBS or whatever are going to let her go. On the other hand, should she?
No. What I honestly think is that...
So Roseanne should, I just want to be clear, Roseanne should and did. Samantha Bee should not and will not lose her job.
No, Glenn. What she said. No, Glenn. Actually, that's not what I mean.
I beg your pardon.
It's interesting. I'm thinking this through right now. Roseanne said something really tacky, and as far as I'm concerned, it makes me look down on her. I look downward upon that.
Okay.
It doesn't make me wonder why I'm alive. I think she did something that makes her look small. Right. If these other people can keep their jobs, there's a part of me that can imagine that Roseanne could have kept doing that show. Maybe certain people would have stopped watching. And to the extent that they didn't stop watching, well, it's a sitcom and life goes on. And Roseanne would have roasted for 2 weeks and would have looked like the small-minded, frankly ignorant, and sometimes apparently drug-addled person that she is.
Yeah.
To me, that would have been punishment enough. But we have the situation where advertisers pull out because of a sense that racism is one of the worst ways that a person can be in society. I find that a bit exaggerated. I feel like the idea is that black people are more delicate than they are, but, you know, better than the way it would have been 50 years ago. So,
well, John, you've said this here before, and you've been spot on, I think, and I think it applies here. It's because of Twitter. Actually, everything is because of Twitter.
Yeah.
It's because advertisers know that a relatively small but intensely interested community of social media users can coin a hashtag and spread the word that you don't want to, you don't want to go to Chick-fil-A, you don't want to go to, wherever, okay? And can have a real impact on the bottom line.
Exactly.
And therefore will keep their distance from the show just to not have to deal with that, whatever they might think. And everybody knows that the threat of this is there. And so therefore Disney is going to yank the ABC offering of Roseanne before it even comes to that, because they know
better to be safe than sorry.
If they move down the tree to that decision node, it's not going to be a good outcome.
Right. And in a way, to bring it full circle, that's the sort of power that racism and anti-racism have. And what you're saying is that that's the society within which, say, the football players go down on their knee or, you know, refuse to salute, as if we aren't in a society where the larger currents are things like what we just talked about, rather than the cop killings, if I take your meaning.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. We'll wrap it up. Until next time.
All right, Glenn.
Thanks for your time and great conversation. We'll see you.
We'll be back.
Yeah.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.